Okay. Well, it is almost 25 minutes to 2, so we are going to start with the afternoon proceedings. My name is Leroy Chatfield, and my fellow panel members will introduce themselves just a little later, but I want to give their names now. Starting on my right is Chris Hartmeyer, and then Esther Urandi, and Abby Flores Rivera, and Jerry Cohen. On behalf of the panel, we would very much like to thank the Cesar Chavez Foundation for sponsoring and hosting this discussion about Cesar Chavez and his fast for nonviolence. We would also like to extend our thanks and appreciation to John Lewis and to John Coons for the photographs that they took in 1968 that you have seen in the exhibit. And unfortunately, John Coons could not be here today, but John Lewis is here. And if John, if you would stand for just in the back there, I'd like to see what, so people can see what you look like. I have to tell you, I have to say that for my money, John Lewis is one of the most gifted photographers that ever walked in the farm worker movement. And we owe a debt of gratitude to his year of work in 1966 and the photos he took in 1968. Thank you, John.
I just went and turned 70, and people ask me what wisdom I can impart that I've acquired over the years. And all I gotta say is art is for suckers.
That's been nice.
A housekeeping matter first. This discussion, and it will be a panel discussion, and then it will be followed by discussion and questions from the audience. This panel discussion is being recorded, professionally recorded, and it will be published on the website of the Farm Worker Movement Documentation Project. And the address for the documentation project, very simple, farmworkermovement.us. That's all you need to know, and it'll take you right there. And there's almost 8,000 photos of the farm worker movement on the website. So for those of you who are interested, you should look into that, I think. The primary claim to fame of the panel members, myself included, of course, is very simple. We were fortunate to be a witness to the fast of Cesar Chavez, and we're fortunate to be alive today to talk about it. I mean, that's sort of the long and short of it. That's why we're qualified, I guess. We were there, and we're alive.
And that's it, folks. You can all go home.
Now, as moderator of the panel, I have a little prerogative here to try to set the historical context of the fast and the context in which it took place. And so, to help me and to help you, I hope, I arrange for 2 boxes of grapes, table grapes, to be present so that they would remind us. Now, these boxes of table grapes remind me of farm workers working in Delano. They remind me of disking, fertilizing, irrigating, pruning, tying, thinning,
suckering.
Tipping, suckering, picking, packing, swamping, all of those farm worker movements, all those farm worker hands-on work are related to these boxes of grapes. In fact, this grape box, if it were 1968, this grape box would have been handled four times by farm workers before it ever left the field. These boxes of grapes remind me of the largest industry in the state of California, $32 billion industry. It's called agriculture. Grapes are the number two crop in California agriculture, $2.7 billion. Now, who can possibly imagine $2.7 billion? I cannot imagine. But if you took these grape boxes and you went to Delano and you stacked them 12 high, and you continued stacking those boxes end to end, 12 high, for 2,500 miles, that would take you to Boston. That is how many boxes of grapes farm workers pick and pack and ship from California. Can you believe that? Now, that is the context in which we're going to talk about nonviolence, Cesar Chavez, and his fast. The strike area in 1966 extended from Ducor on the north to Arvin on the south. That's a distance of 60 miles. And it took in a size of 300 square miles. That was the strike area. There were 33 growers on strike. And I always toss in the Southern Pacific Railroad because they were the number one shipper and supporter of the agricultural industry in the state, certainly in the Delano area. There's only three facts that you need to know about the fast before we get started. One, it began on Wednesday, February 14th. On Monday, February 26th, Cesar Chavez was hailed into court by the growers to answer charges of union violence against the industry. And then the fast ended on Sunday, March the 10th, 1968. So, to begin the program, I would like to have each panel member say their name, and the reason for this is because it's being recorded. I would like you to say your name and tell us very briefly what your assignment was or what your role was at that time. And then briefly again, please be brief, tell us when you first met Cesar Chavez. So if we could start with Chris Hartmeyer.
My name is Chris Hartmeyer. I am a Presbyterian minister, now retired. I met Cesar in September of 1961 when I came to Los Angeles to be the director of the California Migrant Ministry. He was at that time the director of the community service organization in the Southwest. The migrant ministry was close to Cesar and to Fred Ross because my predecessor had gotten a foundation grant that supported our staff to go and train with Cesar and Fred in the CSO for 6 weeks. And when I came to be director, I did the same thing in Stockton with Dolores Huerta and Gilbert Padilla. So in 1968, I was the director of the California Mining Ministry. The office was in Los Angeles. We had staff all over the state and in the San Joaquin Valley particularly. And I probably heard about the fast a couple of days after it had begun when Jim...
Let's hold that question.
Okay.
Just hold that. Esther?
My name is Esther Urandi, and I was a member of the National Farm Workers Association since April of 1964. I had not met Cesar until sometime when the Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee started on their strike, we were working with Joe Mendez at DM Steel in Delano, picking grapes, and we heard that the Filipinos were out on strike. That was September 8th, 1965. Then about 2 days later, that's when we heard that they were out on strike and were going around to the different ranches. We decided to walk out on strike and go to the office to tell Caesar that we had walked out on strike. I don't know why, I guess he wasn't involved in the strike then, but we decided to do that. We had, and I guess it was because we always used to work, in the Urandi family, we always used to work piece rate. Go and do our quota or whatever, and then go home early. And if we weren't getting the wages that we were supposed to be getting, if it didn't come out that, you know, that we got a full day's work, then we'd pull a strike. We'd tell other people, other workers, let's go on strike, you know. So we would go on strike, and then the grower would come, and they would raise our wages, and then we'd go back to work. So that's why we went to the office at 102 Albany and told Caesar. Caesar and Dolores were there. That's the first time I met Caesar. Told him that we had walked out on strike in support of the AWOC workers.
Okay. Abby?
My name is Abby Flores Rivera, and my dad went out on strike the latter part of 1965, and we were a family of 11, then 10 when my brother was shipped off to Vietnam. At the time, 1968, when Caesar began his fast, I was finishing my senior year at Delano High School. And at the very beginning, I helped at the Pink House answering phones. Caesar taught me how to use the telephones because that was very intimidating to me, and he was my teacher. I did filing, and then they found out that I could do a little bit of bookkeeping, so I went to work with Helen at the credit union and was able to work with her. So during the summer or weekends or holidays, I would go help Helen at the credit union, Farm Workers Credit Union. I first met Caesar. I first saw Caesar in the early part of 66. I didn't know who he was. I hadn't seen him. And I was expecting to see somebody wearing a tie and a suit. And he walked in wearing a plaid shirt and khaki pants and boots. And I fell in love with him. And then when he spoke, he was so sincere, and I knew that he was my leader. to let you know that he finally met me when he found out that we were at the Quonset Hut out in the outskirts of Delano on Metzger. And okay, we had broken up and had lunch, and we're having a meeting at lunchtime before we went to picket again out in the fields. And my dad went to talk to Caesar to ask him a quick question. And of course, my sister and I followed Caesar and stood there waiting. And he said, "These are your daughters?" And he said, "Yeah, these are my daughters." "This is your dad?" And I go, "Yeah, that's my dad." "I thought you were students." So that was in 66 when I first met Caesar. And that was a great moment for me.
My name is Jerry Cohen, and I was the general counsel for the Farm Workers Union during the fast. And I was responsible for the defense of the union and for Caesar's defense when the Jamara Vineyards Corporation, in its wisdom, decided to haul us into court on the 12th day of the fast. I had met Caesar the year before. I was working for a legal aid program called California Rural Legal Assistance in McFarland, and they had a condition in their grant that they couldn't represent the union, nor could they have an office in Delano. So I bumped into Caesar at People's Bar playing pool, and I unloaded on him about what I thought should be done by CRLA, and his suggestion was, if you want to help the union, you ought to come to work for the union. And I pointed out that I'd just gotten out of law school and didn't know anything, and he lied and said, "Well, you know, I don't know anything either. We'll just learn it together." And as Abby's already pointed out, we're dealing with a man here who was one hell of a teacher.
And my name, of course, is Leroy Chatfield. I first met Caesar in 1963. I was teaching at a Catholic high school in Bakersfield. I was a member of a Catholic religious order. And we became very close friends, very good friends. And at the time of the FAST, I was the executive director, I guess I was the first executive director, of the National Farm Workers Service Center because it had been started the previous year. So this tells us what we were doing at when the strike started. Now, the first question for the panel is, how did you hear about the FAST? What was your first reaction or your second reaction kind of thing? And briefly, do you remember the reactions from other people around you? Who would like to start?
You want to go this way this time?
Sure.
Leroy, you told me about the FAST on Thursday, the 15th of February. Caesar had stopped eating on Wednesday. And my first reaction was I didn't think Caesar was in very good shape. He was tired. And I thought maybe we should either stop working until he started eating, or maybe we should stop eating until he started eating. And we thought we'd think it over the weekend. My second reaction was markedly different because on Monday the 19th, Caesar gave a speech in Filipino Hall, and unfortunately there was nobody there to record that speech, and that's one of the things I think we can accomplish today is try to be accurate about what Caesar said that day. What Caesar said that day changed my mind. It impressed me. One of the things he said was that he was sick and tired of using the principle of nonviolence at fundraisers or for political purposes. We either meant it or we didn't mean it. The second thing he said was we were living in an era of violence, riots in the city, the war in Vietnam, and there were people, you know, when you have hundreds and sometimes thousands of people involved in a movement, there were people who thought that it was somehow beneficial to engage in acts of violence. And he argued with them that it was morally wrong, and that it was stupid, that it would jeopardize the treasury of the union. And some people's faces glossed over, and they didn't respond to that. And he said, so we're going to think about this. And in order to think about it, I'm going to walk out there, and I'm going to fast. And this fast is not a hunger strike. And he said, if any of you were, and I think his phrase was, chicken shit enough not to eat until I started eating, that would be something that you should be ashamed of. That's a hunger strike, putting pressure on somebody. I just want people to think about the importance of nonviolence, and that's what we're going to do. And as I say, it flipped my opinion. He made a good argument, but there were people in the room who disagreed. There was a father named John Dugan who thought it was asinine. That was his word. Some people that work with me in the legal department said no work would get done during the fast. We wouldn't be answering the phones. We wouldn't be licking stamps. There was a member of the executive board named Tony Orendine who, when he would meet with Caesar during the fast, I remember him not even looking at Caesar. He turned his chair around and looked away. And there's some contemporaneous accounts of this in Jacques Levy's book, so this is not just, you know, isolated memory. So those are some of the reactions I remember.
Who's next?
Well, my office was in Los Angeles. But from the beginning of the strike, Caesar had asked us if we in the migrant ministry would put some staff into Delano to help. And, of course, some money and food caravans, et cetera. And one of the most important things we did really was to assign Jim Drake to be in Delano all the time. So that the way I found out what was actually happening day by day was through Jim. Because I supported him. He had to call me, but everyone else was too busy to call me, so Jim was sort of like the lifeline, the migrant ministry lifeline in Delano. So Jim told me about the fast. I was surprised. It kind of like took me unawares. I hadn't known about the deliberations about violence and nonviolence within the leadership. I had known Caesar was committed to nonviolence, but the fact that he would do this just like took me completely by surprise. And I remember some of our political left supporters feeling that that this was a bad mistake, that Caesar was setting himself up as some kind of a supreme leader, and that this would be a mistake for the whole movement. But mostly church people were very, very drawn to the sacrifice of the fast. And challenged by it, it made them think, it got the word out across the country. And for us, who we were happened to be in a battle with a lot of church people in California, practically every rural church in California wanted to get rid of the migrant ministry because of our support for the union. So we were in this battle every month, really, with people within the church who wanted to end us. And the fast sort of like undercut them. It kind of like took their breath away. It left them without the same kind of ammunition they had had before, in which they would be implying that Caesar was a communist. Caesar was trained by Saul Alinsky. Caesar didn't really care about the workers. Caesar was just there for dues. All those arguments that were being used by the growers and their friends to undermine the credibility of the leadership and of the strike. So the fast was powerful within the community that I was responsible for organizing, the religious community, Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish.
Esther?
I heard about the fast on, was it the 19th? Was it on the 19th when the meeting was called at Filipino Hall for the staff to go to Filipino Hall? I was working in the membership department of the National Farm Workers Association, and the staff were all called to a meeting at Filipino Hall. And we went to the meeting, and Helen and I sat at the same place that we always sat for the Friday night meetings. And that's when Caesar announced that that because of the violence that was happening, being committed against us, and in turn us getting tired of it and doing the same thing, that he was going to partake in a fast. We had been going out to the picket lines. Everyone had been going out to the picket lines, even though we worked in the office. We were going out to the picket lines in the mornings. And I had seen there were a lot of women that were assigned to go in my car, in my little station wagon. We were all assigned. We were assigned to Manuel Chavez, and we would go out. At that time, I think we were hitting Jamara hard. And there were some things that were done, not violent things, but things that were done. I was just reminding Helen the other day, and she remembered some of the things. But one of the things that really got to me was there was a certain time when Jamara was picking up Juanitos in Bakersfield and taking them to the fields, to the Jamara fields. It was pruning. It was February. Pruning time. The pruning season goes from December 15th to about February. And I had seen some men go in. The Thompson grapes have really long vines, and the vines are, they cut the vines. The men were getting the vines, some of our picketers, strikers, getting the vines and hitting the Juanitos. And also getting their shears and going at the legs. So I guess I felt really bad about that. So I told, not that day, but later on I told Caesar about it. And I guess, I don't know, maybe I felt guilty after he did his fast. Was it because of that? But I'm quite sure I'm not the only one that told him anything.
When I first learned about the fast, right?
Yeah, how did you first hear about the fast?
I know that I went to a meeting. I expected it to be a fun meeting with reports from Jerry that were really outstanding and interesting. he was great. And Caesar speaking, and I thought I was going to go to hear some music and sing. It was going to be nice. It was going to be a nice meeting. And then Caesar got up and he told us he was going on a fast. And my first reaction, to be honest with you, I did not know what a fast was. I'm looking, and he said something in Spanish, ayunar or ayunando, and I still had no clue. I didn't know what it was. You know, I didn't know what the word was. And so I remember, I asked my dad, and he said, no comes, you know, you don't eat. And I mean, they kept talking and discussing maybe everything that Jerry's saying, you know, but I was still like, what? Why would he not want to eat? Yeah, it just like really hit me, because You know, I know what it feels like when you don't eat. You know, I know what it feels like to get up in the morning and go to school, maybe not have enough in your stomach, and how it feels right before lunch, and then how it felt to run home and eat a taco frijoles and run back to school. And I knew what it felt like at night, the same way. You know, maybe I had enough to eat, maybe I didn't. And having that you know, that feeling in your stomach that you're hungry. And here this man wants to starve, you know. I just didn't understand it. But then the more he talked and the more he explained, I looked at us and nos regañó. He scolded us. And he told, you know, you made a pledge. You made a pledge, and you're not keeping that pledge. You pledged that you were going, we were going to be nonviolent, and that we hadn't lived up to that pledge. And of course, like Esther, I felt guilty, because when I would go out to the picket lines, if nobody was watching me, I would, you know, yell, and you know, I was good at saying those little cuss words, and you know, doing all those peace signs, the one finger peace sign. And so then at school it was the same thing, you know, very confrontational. And, you know, you just walked around with an attitude, you know, because you knew they better not say anything to me because I'm walking with this attitude. You know, you go to school with kids that were grower kids, contractors kids, and huelistas. And I could not understand. I expected to have some kind of dialogue with my dad driving home because we lived outside of Delano in Rich Grove, 2 miles away, and that was the quietest. My dad was so quiet. To me, that meant that that's how serious it was. I was supposed to say anything about, should I say about the first time when I saw him after he fasted?
No, let's
okay.
Hold that.
No, the only thing is that at that point in the meeting, Caesar got up and he walked out, and he walked to the 40 acres, which was like maybe like 3 miles, and he told us he had already been fasting for 5 days, which was a real surprise to us. And 5 days without eating, I was like, that was like, I could not believe that. And of course, later, as I got older, that was just like, I read something that I said way back 40 years, 35 something years ago, and I go, oh my gosh, I can't believe that he walked after he fasted for 5 days, 3 miles. And so anyway, that's how it affected me. That's where I was, and that's what I remember.
In my case, a few days before the public meeting that we've talked about, Filipino Hall, Caesar asked me, he said, let's take a ride. And we often did that. He often did that because he had to take a break, get out of the office kind of thing. And so we drove out into the rural rows among the vineyards, whatever, and he said, well, let's pull off here. And so he said, I've been fasting. And he said, I'm really worried about it because I don't think I can do it. I practiced, and I just don't think I can do it. Well, fasting for me at that time in my life, I was aware that it had a long, two-century-long history, religious history, fasting, sacrificing, denying oneself. So I saw it as a personal thing that he was doing, which I very much admired. It's not something I could have done, but he was so worried about it that he didn't think he would be able to do it because he was so hungry. Of course he was hungry, but I didn't put two and two together. And then when we had this public meeting at Filipino Hall, and then he made it a public fast, I was just stunned. I felt stupid that I didn't pick up on what he was trying to tell me, I guess. I also felt, as I was sitting there, that he must expect me to do something, since I knew about it in advance, and no one else seemed to know about it in advance that I could figure out. Maybe some did, I don't know. And the only thing that I could think of is I said, okay, because after he said this and walked out, the whole place erupted. I mean, just chaos and people yelling and screaming and maybe not screaming, but shouting anyway. And so I said, look, as long as Caesar is fasting at the 40 acres, that is sacred ground. And no one is going to drive their car on the 40 acres while it is sacred ground. So you park your cars outside and you walk onto the property if you're going to go. And I got up and walked out and went to the 40 acres. And you know what? No one parked their car on the 40 acres because it was sacred ground.
Leroy.
Yeah?
I had the sense that at some point, somebody, probably you, decided that this was a private, personal sacrifice by Caesar, but it was also an organizational opportunity, and that somebody needed to sort of like organize this so that people would know, the world would know, and they would also understand the purpose and significance of it. For example, people started camping at the 40 acres, living there in tents, farm workers mostly, but also some staff.
Mm-hmm.
And like, did that just happen? Did somebody organize that? Was that spontaneous combustion, or was that Leroy Chatfield, the organizer?
Well, there were a lot of organizers. But it didn't happen in such a compressed period of time as you talk about it. It took several days for us to shake ourselves out of what is happening here. My biggest concern right off the bat was, if this comes across as a publicity stunt in the media, we're doomed. It'll be the biggest farce that ever happened. And so
Leroy?
Yeah.
Well, Caesar addressed that in the meeting.
Okay.
And he said that he knew that something like this was so charged that it was going to get out. If it did get out, any of us that were meeting with growers were to stop meeting because this was not going to be pressure on anybody. And that what he wanted us to do was think this over. When you said, for example, it was sacred ground, there were people with whom I worked in the legal department who reacted, does he think he's God? Does he put his pants on one leg at a time? You know, how inflated is he? But when you remember how people dealt with it, when people would come out there to visit Caesar, like I remember Manuel telling these nuns, you can't come in now, sister, he's eating, see? So he was undercutting it with humor. There was none of that inflated element to it, number one. Number two, once it happened, I think Robert Bustos and Pete Cardenas told the workers around Delano. I think Manuel Chavez went north. I think Marshall Gans went south. And I think the other thing that was going on, and this goes to your question, Chris, when Caesar hit Filipino Hall that day, Manuel drove him up. And the first thing he did, he got out of the car and came over to me. He says, he's going to need your help on this one. It was almost as if they were counting votes. You see, we have a problem nowadays. Caesar has become an icon and a myth. And so everybody thinks the man was in charge. What we're dealing with here is a flesh and blood human being who had read Gandhi, who admired King, who understood nonviolence, but who knew there were people in the union who did not really appreciate the religious element of what he was doing and who did not really appreciate nonviolence. So the organizing sort of happened. It wasn't quite spontaneous, but it happened naturally. Leroy wasn't pulling strings like a puppet master. Nobody was. There was a charge in the atmosphere because of what Caesar did. And ironically, the people that were griping at me about no work being done, I would think that if you looked at the history of the union, more organizing got done in those weeks than at any time until the passage of the California Agricultural Labor Relations Act. I think it was the biggest explosion of effort that I've ever seen. And it was because of the energy created by his sacrifice.
Go ahead.
It also made Caesar into a national figure, which the strike had been somewhat visible, but not that visible prior. The march had, you know, made an impact, but nothing made the impact that the fast made in terms of spreading the word out across the United States. And that was supremely evident when Caesar went on his boycott tour in 69. Manuel and I and Juanita Brown and mm-hmm. Mac Lyons and Caesar went off on like a 2-month tour of all the boycott cities, but everybody knew who he was then, and people came. I mean, the organizing crowds was not nearly as big a job as it would have been if it hadn't been for the fast. Well, I don't remember when he got on the cover of time, but
69.
69.
Well, see, the media played a huge role in spreading the word across the national landscape about the fast. The problem was, how does the media find out about what's happening at the 40 acres without me or someone like me telling them? And not wanting to do that because I was afraid that it would be viewed by them as a publicity stunt and it would undercut what Caesar was trying to accomplish. So we fumbled around for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 days trying to figure out how to... See, I wanted the press to call me. That's what I wanted. I did not want to call the press. And finally, it happened. I got a call from Associated Press, just out of the blue. Well, it wasn't out of the blue. I believe it was generated by
good old, what's his name?
Conway. Why can't I think of his first name?
Jack Conway.
Jack Conway, who was head of the Industrial Union Department for the FL-CIO. And I think in Washington, D.C. And I had talked to Jack. I had talked to a lot of people across the country, telling them what was happening, whatever. And he's the one that finally triggered the press, and then they called me. Then the press, they came unglued. They just came. They couldn't believe this. A labor leader fasting. It made no sense to them at all. Now, the ground rules for the media. You won't believe this. The ground rules for the media were that they could not interview Cesar Chavez. That was rule number one. Rule number two, they could not take a picture of him or TV of him if he was outside the room where he was fasting. That was not permitted. Now, they followed those rules. Can you imagine this day and age following those rules? It's unbelievable.
Until court.
When we went to court, they didn't follow the rules.
No, right. Well, that's okay. Anyway, that is how I think the media found out about it. And then, I remember Tom Brokaw coming to the 40 Acres. And there are several other people who became national correspondents. They weren't national correspondents at that time, but came. And I'll tell you, the fast really made a profound impression on them. It was so far out of their experience. So, sorry, I didn't mean to get carried away.
Who set up the first tent on the 40 acres? I think Nick Jones, but I'm not sure.
Nick and Virginia Jones were the first ones to live in the tent. I don't know that they actually set up the tents. We'll get into the tents maybe in a minute, because there's some background to the tents. I mean, it's perfectly understandable when we get into it. Another question I would like to ask the panel is, in the daily or weekly course of the fast, what details do you remember about it? Please describe some of the details you remember best. Details.
During the whole course of the fast?
Not the whole course of the fast. Let's just, the first couple of weeks of the fast, as the fast was getting started. Let me tell you a detail. I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. I went out to the 40 acres. We had built this brand new gas station out of adobe brick. We didn't open it because Caesar was going to live there. And so there was a room there. He said he wanted to stay in that room. It was like a little office, so he was going to stay there. Then there was this bigger room that was going to be for parts and tires and batteries and all that stuff, right? Some of the women showed up at the 40 acres, and I remember, the one name I do remember, Lourdes Dahili, Filipino woman, showed up. They came with paintbrushes, little paintbrushes, and they started to decorate the windows of this room. They were making a chapel out of it. They were making stained glass windows out of it. Now, who told them to do that? I didn't tell them to do that.
No.
That, when I say details, that is a detail that lives with me to this day.
People people started, some of the other women came in and joined in. I remember I was involved, Helen was involved too. I think some of the girls, some of your sisters were involved in painting the windows at the 40 Acres Hall. A lot of people started coming in and painting all the windows at the hall and at the gas station. Mm-hmm.
Any other details?
Well, I remember a conversation with Caesar because, remember, on the 12th day of the fast, we were going to go to court because Jamar was going to try to throw him in jail for contempt of court. And we were talking. He wanted to know how that was shaping up. And to me, it was crucial because the fast was also, in addition to being a personal commitment that Caesar made, it was the organizational glue that pulled together 9 different ranch committees that had been working on their own administration of contracts. They had something in common to work on, which was the demonstration in court. But ironically, there was a reaction among some people in the union who thought that it was too much focused on Caesar. And we were talking about this, and Caesar's response was really good. He said, there are going to be a lot of balls bouncing on this one. Keep your eye on the red one. He said, some people on the far left don't understand that if you're going to work with poor people, you have to understand their religion. You can't be threatened by it. You work with it. There's nothing that's inconsistent with someone having a religious commitment and also using whatever the event is as an organizing tool. They're not mutually exclusive. And I just thought he had a humorous way of putting it. He was well aware of what was happening, but he was very curious about the specifics of how, what is shaping up when we have to go to court. We didn't know if he's going to end up in jail that day. And I, you know, I'd never done one of those hearings, and I was pretty nervous. But I remember that phrase, keep your eye on the red one.
Abby, anything to add?
I just remember that, what I remember specifically is that here I was at high school, and life just went on. You know, here was Caesar at 40 Acres fasting, and we were getting up in the morning. We were taking the bus into town. We were all in school. I was in school. Caesar's kids were in school. The Huelguistas were in school. And here was our leader over there fasting, and it was really hard to deal with. And I also remember that we still did our homework. I was talking to one of Caesar's daughters, and I said, we still did our homework. We still did our homework. And, you know, he was over there. The whole idea of nonviolence, something that, you know what, after that, I became very much aware of it. I think that I hit so many books in the library to learn about Gandhi and find out more about it. And then I saw that, you know, this was something that we really needed to know more about it and just live up to that whole idea of nonviolence, that Caesar was doing this and we weren't understanding. He was way ahead of us and he needed to bring us with him and he needed us to understand. And I think that as farm workers, I think that we learned and that was a very important time for us because I think it was like the glue that kind of brought us all together, it recommitted us to what we were doing. And I think that, you know, my family was not Catholic. We were not, I'm not Catholic, I'm Baptist. And yet, all the different religions, all the different people, all the different farm workers, we saw something in the whole idea of nonviolence that made a lot of sense. Because using violence would have destroyed us. And I know that he was teaching us about something that was so contrary to us. You know, with a raza, we fight and we ask questions later, you know? We don't, you know, somebody looks at us sideways, all right, ¿qué pasó? You know, so this was an idea that we had to put to practice, and it was very, very difficult. But one thing that Caesar always said is that there's power in nonviolence, and I could not understand it, but you know what? We all became focused. We all saw why he was putting himself through this. For nonviolence, I mean, let's take a closer look at it, you know? And then now, let's not just give it lip service, let's practice it.
You talk about the fast being the glue that brought people together. The other side of that coin, however, is that what became clear to me immediately at Filipino Hall when Caesar made the announcement was that he drew a line in the dirt. And you were either going to step over that line with him or you weren't. And I'll tell you, some people would not, it wasn't the glue that held them together.
No.
They were angry. And I'm talking about leadership in the union. I'm not talking about...
Tony Orendine, I think, was Secretary Treasurer,
mm-hmm.
wasn't he? He left shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
Some people that work with me in the legal department left thereafter because they were annoyed that I was talking to Caesar about the courthouse demonstration rather than doing God knows what I was supposed to be doing in the legal department at that point. It was clear to anybody with sense that something important was going on, that these ranch committees were working together. As Abby said, people were coming together both in terms of arguing about the issues and coming down mostly on Caesar's side, but the people that didn't left. And that's why I thought it was important. And when Manuel said he's going to need your help on this one, that said something to me. Caesar's rolling the dice here. This was, I don't like to use words like heroic, I never do. I mean, this was a man putting everything at stake, and I can't emphasize enough that this is not an icon or a saint at work. This is a guy that put it all on the line. He didn't know where it was going to end up. I'm convinced of that. It was a hell of an act.
I remember a couple of specifics. One, I remember Caesar's attention to detail, even while fasting, but at the same time as the fast went on, he just got quieter and more peaceful, and I think more at peace with himself and what was going on around him. The fast had a very, very potent impact on Caesar's spirit. And then the other thing I remember always is the every night religious service, which ended always in a mass. And I was there for many of those, and you know, I don't know who was organizing them, but it took some work to get a clergy there also for those every night events. And Caesar was always present, and even when he got very, very, very weak.
Right. Well, of course, Father Mark Day was assigned to Delano, who was the Franciscan priest at that time, and so he was, in effect, for lack of a better word, the union chaplain, I suppose. And these masses started, they started very small. But Jerry has alluded to this, but a strange phenomenon happened. People began to come. I mean, I'm talking about from all over California.
Right.
I'm talking about farm workers. From Arizona. They came, and because they were coming, they had no place to stay. And that led to, well, what are we going to do? We didn't have enough bathroom facilities. We didn't have any places for people to stay, whatever. So we started with the tents. And we had a tent city. We might probably had, my goodness, there must have been 50, 60, 80 tents. Nick Jones and Virginia were the first ones, of my recollection, were to stay overnight in the tent. They sort of set the example. Before I knew it, Bonnie, my wife and I, and our only daughter at that time, Claire, we started spending a night or two in the tents, but it just became a happening. It just became a... Mm-hmm. We had to accommodate people. And I'm just telling you that every night, more and more and more people came. And Caesar did more organizing flat on his back by meeting one-on-one with everyone who... See, after the Mass, people would line up. And they might wait for an hour. They might wait for 2 hours until their turn came to go inside the room with their family or themselves and to talk to Caesar. And that was fantastic organizing. Fantastic.
Do you remember Jim Drake's role at this time? I don't think Jim was enamored with the fast at first.
I don't think Jim was either, but I can't... But I can't say that I can think of something specific, you know, where he really grabbed hold, you know. I mean, he went along, and I think he warmed up to it.
Yes, he came.
He did. He came along.
He joined, but it took him a while.
It did. Well, what I'd like to...
You may want to tell people who Jim Drake is.
Chris Hartmeyer already talked about Jim Drake. Okay, Jim Drake was a member of the migrant ministry, answered to Chris Hartmeyer, and he was assigned full-time in Delano. So thank you, Ed.
That's very funny. We assigned staff to the union, and they answered to me, ho, ho, ho. I answered to Caesar, and they answered to Caesar.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Nothing's ever changed.
Esther, did you want to add
something? Well, I wanted to add something that, you know, every night people coming from all over for the masses. First they started inside, and then it started outside in front of the gas station. And more people coming every night, and people bringing pictures of saints, crucifixes, all kinds of stuff. In fact, not too long ago, I asked Paul, did you know whatever happened to everything that was stored on top of the gas station, because that's where it was stored. And so people would come and put them up all over the place. I remember the little crosses that they had above where Caesar was, there was the little crosses made by vines that they would present to him every night of the fast.
To mark the passing of the fast. Yeah. Right. I'd like to move on to what I call the Kern County Cathedral Courthouse scene. Mm-hmm. Would someone like to start that discussion?
Let me give it a shot, Leroy.
All right.
I got up that morning and I was pretty nervous. I had always had good constitutional arguments to make in the Kern County Courthouse, but they always fell on deaf ears. I always used to feel really physically almost nauseated going there. And I took a little solace from Bill Russell, who you may not know, but he won 11 championships with the Boston Celtics. He used to throw up before basketball games, and he said, if you weren't nervous, you weren't worth a damn. But I knew that constitutional arguments in front of those judges didn't really count for much. So I got up early, and I drove out to just look at things one more time, and out of the fog came cars. There must have been 300, 400, maybe even 500 cars with farm workers heading to that courthouse. Marshal Gans had been down there a few days before, scoping out the courthouse, figuring out how many people can we get into this courthouse. And when we got there, Leroy, you'll remember, mm-hmm. there were between 3,000 and 4,000 workers lined up in the hallways outside the court, making a sort of a pathway for us to go down. You and I were on each side of Caesar, and it felt great. And from my point of view, it was like, this place has been enemy turf ever since I got to the Union. It's not enemy turf anymore. And we went up a staircase, or rather an escalator to the second floor, and I'll never forget this, because on Caesar's left, there's a bank of cameras and everything. He stumbled, and I'm on his right side, and I said, are you okay, Caesar? And he winked at me. Now, this is a guy on the 13th Davis Fast. He winked at me basically to reassure me, yeah, I'm okay, but he also saw those 3,000 farm workers. That's number one. Number two, Jamara's attorney, Bill Quinlan, wanted the workers removed from the courthouse. And there was a case, for those interested, called Edwards versus South Carolina, that gives people the right to peacefully demonstrate in public buildings. So we went into the judge's chambers. I laid out the constitutional law, knowing what kind of reaction I was probably going to get, because that's the same reaction I always got. And in chambers, Judge Osborne looks at Quinlan and he says, look, Bill, if I tell Jerry he's got to kick his clients out of this courthouse, that will be just another example of goddamn gringo justice. I had never heard a Kern County Superior Court judge talk like that, and if there weren't 3,000 farm workers there, that would not have happened, no matter what the Constitution says.
So what did the court do that day?
They continued the, they didn't decide, they decided that they couldn't try Caesar that day, they continued it. So we came back again, and then they continued it again, and eventually they dismissed it. Now, underlying this, even though the court was that was ours that day, there were violations of the injunctions. They don't sound that important now, but Caesar was concerned. You know, little dirt clods that get baked in the sun can be hard. People that are frustrated tend to pick those dirt clods up once in a while and throw them at people. Now remember, when we struck Jamara on August 3rd of 67, we did well for a while, but they can break a strike. We started boycotting our grapes. All of Jamara's buddies put their labels in there. What happened? We decided we'd roll the dice, we'll boycott the whole industry. We didn't know how that would work out. Caesar had faith that it would work, and he kept arguing with people it's going to take time, you're going to have patience. But, you know, when you're in that fog-bound valley in the winter, you don't see very clearly or very far. People were getting frustrated. There were rumors. In addition to the dirt clods, there was a shed called the Prospero Shed that had burned down. When Caesar announced his fast, he said, if it's a union supporter, you're doing the wrong thing, we'll provide you with legal help. If it's some grower trying to set us up, that won't work. If it's a grower who does it for insurance, that won't work either. You know, ironically, Ron Taylor, who is this reporter for the Bee, wrote investigative articles later and found, and this is not an uncommon thing, found that some volunteer firemen were setting fires in the strike area so they could have a little work. And they knew that where would the fires be blamed? They'd be blamed on the union. Now, that's not to say that everybody was angels, because everybody wasn't angels. And Caesar was trying to control those rogue members of the union that were trying to take, you know, action and take things into their own hands. But I'll tell you, you talk about that courthouse, that day was a totally transformed building.
Well, let's pursue this for a minute. You talk about dirt clods and the Prospero shed that burned down, which was a shack. Should have burned down a long time ago. But I'm sure it was done for insurance purposes, business, I mean, you know. But, I mean, it's not like I know. But, listen, let's not kid ourselves. Anyone who's involved in a strike has flirted with violence. And starting with me and the rest of us on this panel, I'm sure. Now, how difficult is that to understand? I mean, strike breakers are being bussed in and air-conditioned buses. You're on the picket line like I was on the picket line, and they come busting by you, and you can't even talk to them. You can't do nothing. They take them into the camps, and then the next day you're on the picket line, and those workers that have been bussed in are in the fields. You have no access to them. Listen, those scabs have to be dealt with. They do. Now, how do you do that? That's the dilemma. How do you do that? How do you intimidate them? In the early days of the strike, the union had marches in neighborhoods, at candlelight vigils in the evening, going down the streets of the neighborhood and picketing and demonstrating in front of labor contractors who were breaking the strike, right? Or people, known strike breakers in the community, they were crossing the picket lines, they have a demonstration. They were trying to put pressure, they were trying to confront these strike breakers and shame them, force them, urge them, whatever, to not break the strike. Well, it worked sometimes, it didn't work other times. Now, I heard vines were cut, I heard pumps were disabled. I heard, those are primarily the ones that I heard, irrigation pumps and vines. But you know what? A couple of years ago, I wrote an essay called Strike Violence Versus Nonviolence, which is published on the website. And I've given a lot of thought to this. The people that I heard this reports from, I'm talking about strikers, organizers, mostly strikers. A third of it was wishful thinking. A third of it was bravado after a couple of beers. And a third of it might be true. But...
Well, Leroy, here's an example of that that's, I think, important. One morning, outside the Pink House, Father Dugan came to see me. John Dugan, see, macho stuff doesn't just apply to Chicanos or Mexicans. People that love the IRA and, you know, this romantic violence in Ireland or over there, there are a lot of people that think violence is clever for a lot of reasons. And John Dugan was a nice man, but John Dugan, I think, didn't believe in the power of nonviolence. And John Dugan said to me that he heard a rumor. Now, here you're getting layer on layer of talk. It's just rhetoric. He heard a rumor from Tony Orendine that some workers might take hand grenades and blow up the Jamara shed. And I said, well, first place, I don't believe it. And by the way, nobody ever found a hand grenade anywhere near Delano, and nothing like this ever happened. So I thought this was just a lot of inflated rhetoric. But I pointed out to Father Dugan that day that if they happened to go down there that day, if that happened to be true, Leroy and Caesar were down there soliciting service on the contempt citation, so they'd blow Caesar sky high. That's a really smart thing to do. Now, I had to tell Caesar that, even though I didn't believe it. And Caesar, when he heard rumors like this, had to assume the worst. We knew some sheds had burned. We knew some pumps had burned. We knew dirt clods had been thrown. That was the one strong allegation Quinlan had in his declarations. But we didn't know, as Leroy said, how much of this is bravado. But even this kind of talk is not healthy. It's not good for the union. Now, I never believed that happened. Well, I never believed it was going to happen. Caesar's reaction to that to me was very, it's typical. He said, you know, some of these people just don't understand. I've argued with people that this is not only wrong, that it's stupid, and they still talk this way. Even talking this way could then somehow legitimize something. So whether it was bravado or reality, in Caesar's mind, didn't make a lot of difference at some point. He wanted that line drawn, as you said, in the sand, and you either stepped across it or you didn't.
But also our AFL-CIO labor supporters did not have exactly a tradition of nonviolence.
That's right.
And brought with their support, you know, their support brought also this tradition of break a few legs and it works. Right. And so Caesar had that to deal with, and I think some in the labor movement were kind of like totally confused by the fast.
They were.
They were totally confused by nonviolence, too. I remember being on the picket line with UAW members from the Ford from the Ford Motor Company, UAW representatives from the Ford Motor Company, on the picket line with us, and they began making fun of us on the picket line. Why are you out here? You see those goddamn strikers in the scabs, and why don't you go in and beat the shit out of them? Why? You look at what you put up with. You got the cops here and all that. Why do you take that? And they began to mock us. This is not the way you build a union. I mean, that was just what you're saying. It was very discouraging. You know, I mean, after a while, you began to think, well, geez, maybe we're not going to win. Esther, why don't you? You were on the picket line.
You're going to have to tell everything.
We're a special group assigned to Mayo Chavez. I won't say anything.
Could we go back to the, because I'm not convinced yet, could we go back to the Kern County Cathedral Courthouse for a minute? Most of you probably have never seen the Kern County Courthouse. I mean, it's a huge building. It's what, 4 or 6 stories high? When you walk through those halls on that day, you could hear a pin drop in that entire building and in those hallways, even though the walls were jammed with farm workers lined every floor, every wall. The only thing you could hear was some people were saying the rosary very softly, very much to themselves. When we walked by the people that were lying on the farm workers on the walls, lining the walls, when Caesar came through there, there was a murmur. Some people knelt. It was really eerie. I mean, it just transformed an entire building. I couldn't believe it. And I'll tell you, for 40 years after that, I have used that tactic. It works, but it takes a lot of discipline, and it takes a lot of organization to make that happen. And I'll tell you, Marshall Gantz played a major, major role in organizing that, what I call the Kern County Cathedral Courthouse.
And it had a huge effect on the staff of the people, of the judges and the people in the courthouse. Mm-hmm. Weeks later, I'd go in there and people would say things, you know, we've had 12 high school kids in here before making more noise than 3,000 people did. How did that happen? It profoundly affected them.
Esther, you were there that day. What do you remember?
Well, I remember I did walk in when we got there. I saw all these thousands and thousands of people outside the courthouse, and they were, some of them were kneeling, some were standing, and all over the courthouse. And then inside, I walked inside, and it was, the hallways were just cluttered just with people. And I think that I remember that the courthouses, because we didn't know where Caesar was going to be, which courthouse he was going to be in.
Which courtroom?
So all
which courtroom.
Yeah. So all the courtrooms were full of people.
No, we took over the entire building, and there wasn't a damn thing they could do about it. Now, I was young. I was naive, but boy, I'll tell you, I learned that lesson from Caesar that day. I mean, it's amazing what can be done when it's disciplined and when it's organized and when it's nonviolent. It's amazing. Yeah, go ahead.
Not the courthouse, but
all right.
But at the campsite.
Okay.
That eerie feeling that you described.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I felt it. It was night. I went with one of the family members, and that was like later on, toward maybe three-fourths of the way during Caesar's fast. And when I saw him, he looked to me real tired and. It just broke my heart to see the way he looked. But after I went in and I stopped at the door. I had gone there another time earlier and was able to go up almost up to him. But this second time, I didn't want to go all the way in. It was too hard for me. So I stood by the door and then afterward went out into the camp area. And it was really dark and it was real dusty. And it was really quiet. And I could hear people, I heard a couple in a tent talking. I mean, here you had a lot of tents, a lot of people, and it was so quiet. And as I was walking, it was dark, it was kind of hard for me. And I remember it was dusty, and I thought, oh my gosh, it almost feels like, is this, I don't know, it is, you know, like, kukui, scary, you know, because.